This is Columbia Morning with David Lyon on News Talk 1400 KFRU.
And it just turned 8:40 on this Friday morning. This is the 29th of April. This month has been, I believe it is a special month of drawing attention to autism and the challenges that it has. It's Autism Awareness Month, and so we get on the final day that we'll be doing this show and just a couple of days left of that. We have the Executive Director of the Thompson Center at the University of Missouri, Thompson Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders, and he is Dr. Stephen Canny, and he's been our guest before. Dr. Canny, good to talk to you again. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine.
I'm going to talk specifically about something that was announced from the Thompson Center just a few days ago, but let's talk in broader general terms. As you think about a month that is dedicated to autism awareness, what do you think the general public needs to understand about autism and may keep in mind this month?
No, that's a very good question, a very broad question. So, you know, autism has entered the public's conscious, I think, in such a large way over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, 10, 15 years ago, no one had even really heard of autism. There might have been a couple people who would raise their hand in an audience. Now you go give a talk or something, you say, does anyone know anyone, a relative or someone who has autism? And almost everybody raises their hand. And I think what that reflects is how much more awareness there is out there and how much the success the campaigns like Autism Awareness Month have had. You know, autism has so many different myths around it in the past. There are so many questions people have about what autism is and how does it work and how do people who have autism function, that, you know, just all this effort to try to make people understand a little bit better and demystify it have really worked. And this month has been a great example of that.
One of the questions that I think regularly comes up when you're talking about autism, or you could pretty much almost put all kinds of different words in there, but in autism, you talk about how people now are more aware of it because they probably know someone or it has touched their life in some way. Is there incidence of it more now, or is it more because we've just been able to identify it more than we did in the past?
Another really good question. The way I like to describe it is think about a bucket. So in the past, maybe 10, 15 years ago, the bucket of things that we put autism into that we called autism was smaller. And now over the years, as we learn a lot more about the genetics of autism, the biology of autism, what autism really is, that bucket has gotten bigger and bigger so that there are more people who we put into that bucket that weren't in that bucket before. So if you look at the big national studies and listen to the people who do the research on incidence and prevalence, most people believe that, you know, it's remained about the same, even though, like, there's this, we have fears of an epidemic of autism. Well, what we're really learning is it really hasn't changed. It's about 1% of the population, maybe a little bit more in some places, a little bit less in others. But for the most part, 1% of the population have autism. The difference now is that we're actually recognizing those people, diagnosing them correctly with the disorder, and putting them in that diagnostic category. So there might have been people who we called something else before, you know, maybe schizophrenic or maybe intellectual disability, that we're now recognizing truly do have autism. That being said, there are some studies that do show that there are other types of factors that may influence increases in autism in certain areas or even in our current times.
We're talking with the executive director of the Thompson Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders at the campus of the University of Missouri. We're going to talk specifically about something that was announced, a launch of, and the acronym is SPARK, in a moment. But I like this conversation, and I have another. It's just a two-part question. Part one is, how is funding from different sources coming along for the study of autism? But then my other question involves that in that, is more money available for spending how to deal with it after it happens? Or is there any money and any dream of saying, let's study how you prevent it?
I think okay, to answer both your questions, there has been more funding that's directed towards autism over the last 5 years, both by not only the government in terms of NIH funding and research, but also just in terms of private foundations. There's a little bit more actual foundations that have actually put up money to enhance and accelerate the research that's being done. It's really interesting because a lot of the funding has gone to the genetics and why the etiology of autism, meaning like where is this coming from and how is autism caused? Because if you really think about it, that's such an important question. The more we understand about where autism comes from genetically, then that might lead to much better understanding of how to treat autism. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think there's some frustration out there. It's like, well, heck, that's great, but guess what? My child has autism right now. You know, my now 21-year-old has autism right now, and we need to do something for them right now. So there has been a bigger push lately to focus a little bit more funding, a little bit more attention on how do we treat people who have autism right now in the workforce, and you know, if they're 14 and 15 in school. So there's been kind of a split in the funding with regard to that. So.
Tell me how big the umbrella is again. When you mentioned the word autism, how much does that cover? I think you talked about that just a few moments ago when you were saying people have an understanding now of how to define autism that they used to define with other terms. But when we're looking at an autistic, a child with autism, that could mean from one side of the pole, what kind of functioning to the other end of the pole.
And I think that's what makes our job so challenging and also so incredibly fascinating, too, in terms of I love working with these kids and these families. I have no idea sometimes, you know, how the child's going to look when they walk through the door. If you think about some other disorders, whatever you say, maybe Down syndrome, maybe something else, you have a general sense of how these kids and how these adults are going to be. In autism, there are these core symptoms that are affected, how they interact socially, how they communicate, and some other behaviors they show. But beyond that, there's just so much variation in the kid that can walk through the door. So, you know, I've worked with kids who are genius level IQs. I've worked with kids with autism who are on the cognitively disabled side. Yes. I've worked with kids who are talk show hosts. I've worked with others that are completely nonverbal. It can have seizure disorders, GI problems, ADHD symptoms. They can have sleep difficulties. They can have anxiety problems. But at the very core of it are those social problems and these very repetitive behaviors and other things that they can show.
So you're
absolutely right. I mean, they can look a thousand different ways.
So that is what you would categorize it as autism, what you just said at the end of that, because I was wondering how could such variety come underneath the same label?
And that's exactly what prompted the shift in our thinking to, instead of calling it autistic disorder, to call it an autism spectrum disorder. Mm-hmm. So that is a term we use now. It's really the acknowledgement that it is a true spectrum of kids and people who are presented to us.
How special is the Thompson Center at the University of Missouri?
We are a very unique place. There's only one or two places like us in the entire country where we have a standalone building that its only purpose is to evaluate kids with neurodevelopment disorders, with autism being one of our specialties. So we from diagnosis all the way through treatment, from age as soon as they're born to into adulthood, we provide diagnostic services and treatment services across the entire spectrum.
Something has just happened. It's the Simons Foundation Powering Autism Research for Knowledge, and that would be an acronym, SPARK.
It's SPARK is so much easier to say.
Yeah, it is. So, but you need to know what that is. And so what is this?
This is one of the largest and most ambitious studies this foundation and the country and us as a part of it have undergone. What this is we're trying to understand the genetics of autism better. We have about 50 genes we know are directly related to autism and almost 1,000 genes that we know are somehow related to autism. So it's this huge puzzle to try to figure out what's going on with autism. So what we need, to be honest with you, is more numbers. We need more people that have the genetics that we can understand and really dive into trying to understand where does autism come from. So this particular project, we're aiming to recruit 50,000 people across the country that have autism and their parents and siblings if possible, and collect their DNA and then do the really high-powered finely grained analysis to find out the genetics of autism. So our site is one of 21 sites across the country. We were actually a pilot site for it that's part of this research project.
So how are you getting the families? How are you getting these samples?
We set this up. You know, in this age of social media, we're trying to make this as easy as possible for families. So all they have to do, they can go to our website, for example, our Facebook page, and they click on a link. And that link takes them to a page where they fill out maybe 15 minutes worth of information. Once they do that, the Simons Foundation, who's sponsoring this study, they send them a kit. This kit, all they have to do is take a little cotton swab and swab out some saliva in their mouth. They put it back in the kit, ship it back to the Simons Foundation, and they actually get $50 for doing it, and they're done. It's really that simple.
Do they have to have already had a diagnosis of autism of some sort and know that that's in the family?
All we're asking for there is the parents have to state that there has been a professional diagnosis of autism. Uh-huh. Again, to get as many numbers as we can, that's the only requirement that we're having for this. I'll tell you what, though, the cool thing about this study, though, too, aside from the genetics, is we're really really trying to create a community, a virtual community of people who have autism. So if you can imagine 50,000 people who are all part of this common website and this common virtual community, then we can start, they can ask questions of experts, they can, you know, they can talk to each other to provide support and resources. So we're really trying to make it much more than just the genetics piece, but make it into the future something that can really benefit the entire community.
Almost a supportive group.
Exactly.
So I guess you would find parents, caregivers, guardians of children with autism that come in with all kinds of mental approach to that.
Yeah, so some people enjoy the research part. Some people want to be to give back to the community. Some people are a little bit afraid of it. Some people are like, I don't understand this. So we really try to answer as many questions as we can.
But then I guess also the other thing I was meaning was that some would come in saying, all right, this is a challenge, but I'm up for this challenge. I'm positive about this. And others would come in a little bit more hesitant thinking, oh, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this.
Yeah, no, that is another really good point. It really depends on the family, kind of where they're at, how long they've actually tackled the problem, the challenge, and how bad or how challenging that problem is for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the really young kids, for example, when it's the first initial diagnosis, it can be a very kind of difficult thing to go through, saying, oh my gosh, my child has this. What is this going to mean for my life? Yeah, then you have families who've been dealing with, you know, kids 8, 9, 10 years old. They're like, we got this. You know, we've been doing this for a while, and we understand. We're just looking for resources and help.
Generally, at what age is this diagnosed?
We can actually push the diagnosis down very accurately to about 2 years of age. We can, if the symptoms are obvious before that, we can diagnose as early as 12 months of age, very consistently. The average age of diagnosis across the country is more like 4 years of age, and that's because of the people just don't recognize a problem. They don't bring them into the clinic before that. So that's why these awareness things like this autism awareness month is so important. So if we get it out to the pediatricians that if you suspect autism or the parents, come in, get it checked out, because the earlier we can get your child into treatment, that derailment isn't going to be as impacted. We can get them back on track as fast as possible.
And again, what would be a sign that a parent or grandparent or teacher or friend maybe in preschool would look for to say, well, I've got a concern here, let's check it out?
Yeah, there are some really basic things that we look for. One, the big thing is language. So if there's some type of language delay, kids should be speaking in single words by about 12 months to 14 months. If there's any delay past that, ask your pediatrician. You know what they found, though, to be honest with you, is that mothers, especially, if they suspect something's going on with their child, 80% of the time, they're right. So what we're trying to empower parents to do is, like, listen to your instincts. Push it if you think there's something wrong. They're not turning to their name like they should. They're not smiling. There's something seems off. Push it. There's another measure that people can do free online called the MCHAT, M-C-H-A-T. Just Google that. And that does a free online 23-question kind of questionnaire, which doesn't tell you if they have autism, but it tells them if there's a risk of it. And if they ding on that, then they can actually pursue an evaluation even further.
What is the time frame that you think after you collect these 50,000 individuals that have autism information, DNA for genetic analysis, then what would be the most positive, optimistic result that you might think of from this SPARK study?
They start analyzing the data once they get big enough numbers, even before the 50,000. Because what has fascinated me, and we just went to a conference about a month ago with some of the world's leading geneticists in the field, this field is moving so quickly in terms of the genetics, and that there's so many discoveries being made. There's so many new technologies. Even if someone has had genetic testing done 4 or 5 years ago, there are new genetic tests that are developed that actually look even closer at the specific regions of the chromosomes that can make discoveries. So I'd be afraid to say. We're trying to make discoveries even on a monthly basis with regard to this. They need the numbers to come in, though. So as soon as they get the big enough numbers to start looking at those questions, that's when we'll start making discoveries.
I'm going to let you go in just a moment. Just a couple more final questions about Thompson Center. How many people work there? How many are researchers? How many are clinicians? How do you divide that up?
Yeah, so we, like I said, we have a breadth of, we do training here, we do research, and we have clinicians who see the patients. So we have about 85 people. We have about half of those are about faculty members that conduct research but also see patients clinically. So we have psychiatrists, geneticists, pediatricians, developmental pediatricians, psychologists, neuropsychologists, nursing, speech language, occupational therapists, all who work here that help see the kids but also do the research. But we also train nationally and now internationally in terms of how do you approach diagnoses of autism.
People come from a long way to be at Thompson, don't they?
All across the world now.
Thompson Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders. The executive director of that is Dr. Stephen Canna. He's been our guest. We'll let you go. Best of luck with this. Keep us informed if you need to put the word out there again. But we hope that you get a lot of samples and can make great strides in the research and treatment of this. So thank you.
I love your show. Anytime you guys want me on there, please let me know.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Stephen Canna, who is the executive director of Thompson Center. Again, wrapping up the month that is labeled as Autism Awareness Month, but just starting, as just announced a few days ago, MU through the Thompson Center's involvement with SPARC, which stands for the Simons Foundation Powering Autism Research for Knowledge. And if you want more, then go on the Facebook page for the Thompson Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders, or contact that center at the University of Missouri, and they'll be happy to share information with you. This is News Talk 1400 KFRU.